From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, renowned naturalist and filmmaker David Attenborough talks with us about the stars of his new film, Birds, including the flightless kiwi. He'll tell us about the lengths he went to tracking down rare birds in the wild. Attenborough's new book is The Life of Birds. The PBS series will appear later this year. Also, examining the world's environmentally damaged places, where famine or air and water pollution take a human toll. We talk with journalist Mark Hertzgard about his travels and his new book, Earth Odyssey. TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's premiere of 60 Minutes 2 and Maureen Corrigan on a first novel, Amy and Isabel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The impeachment trial of President Clinton has adjourned for the night after House impeachment managers began presenting their case to the Senate. They argued the president should be removed from office for allegedly lying under oath and obstructing justice. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
After an introduction by House Judiciary Chair Henry Hyde, Congressman James Sensenbrenner began by telling senators the president had repeatedly tried to place himself above the law. Sensenbrenner focused on the critical importance of honesty in the American system of justice.
A Senate conviction of the president in this matter will reaffirm the irrefutable fact that even the president of the United States has no license to lie under oath.
Sensenbrenner and the other 13 House managers have a total of 24 hours to make their case before the Senate. In briefs filed today, they stated that they wanted to call live witnesses to testify in this case, but the Senate is divided on partisan lines about this question and won't decide until both sides have presented their case. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton was scheduled to fly to New York this evening, but the White House now says the trip has been canceled because of snow and freezing rain in the New York area. Bad weather has settled in across much of the Northeast, leading to flight cancellations, school closures, and nightmarish traffic. 180 of the day's regular flights were canceled at the Newark International Airport in northern New Jersey. Temperatures in Connecticut dipped as low as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, including the wind chill, glazing the roads with ice and causing a steady stream of accidents. The postmaster of Detroit said today that deep snow on the city streets has kept nearly 10,000 people from receiving their mail for weeks. Roger Adams of member station WDET reports.
Postmaster Lloyd Wesley outlined emergency procedures today for delivering mail to city residents who've been snowbound since January the 2nd. He issued a plea to shovel sidewalks and steps leading to houses. He said when letter carriers encounter unshoveled sidewalks, they will honk their horns and wait 60 seconds. If no one appears, they will drive to the next address. Wesley also agreed today that it is time the city appealed for help from the Michigan National Guard.
Whatever it takes, the bottom line, we need to deliver the mail to the public.
Nearly 2 feet of snow has blanketed Detroit. The city's residential streets remain unplowed. For NPR News, this is Roger Adams in Detroit.
President Clinton will reportedly propose a new 55-cent-a-pack cigarette tax with the proceeds to be used to finance some of his domestic spending initiatives. An administration official told reporters that the tax could raise as much as $8 billion. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 228 points to close at 9,121 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The European Commission is pledging to curb corruption after surviving a controversial censure vote. The European Parliament rejected a motion that would have forced the resignation of the entire Commission, the executive arm of the 15-member European Union. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Paris.
The retreat came only at the last minute, after party leaders warned of chaos if the Commission's work was frozen. The Commission faces crucial decisions as the EU prepares to expand into Eastern Europe. It had been celebrating success after launching the single currency, the euro, but critics say the fraud and favoritism scandal shows how unaccountable the Commission remains, even as it takes on an ever larger role in Europeans' daily lives. The Parliament vote calls on the Commission to set up an independent fraud unit, create a code of ethics, and annually review its members' interests. The first results of a corruption probe are due in mid-March, and some parliament members already warn that if they're not pleased, they'll bring up another motion to censure. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Paris.
The International Monetary Fund's representative in Russia acknowledged today that the lending agency's $22 billion aid package for Russia has been abandoned. IMF official Martin Gilman said the plan hasn't been revived since August, when it was frozen after Russia effectively defaulted on several debts and devalued the ruble. Gilman said the Russian government and IMF officials will try to come up with a new plan when they meet in Moscow next week. The IMF has insisted that President Boris Yeltsin's government implement an effective recovery program before it sends more money. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. For the past 40 years, David Attenborough has had a great job. He's traveled to remote and exotic places around the world, making television programs that explain the wonders of nature. His BBC series and companion book, Life on Earth, traced the 3.5 billion year history of evolution. The living planet examined different ecosystems, and the private life of plants revealed just that. Throughout his broadcasting career, which included an illustrious tenure as head of the BBC, Attenborough has tracked down creatures and images never before seen by Westerners, let alone captured on film. In one memorable scene from Life on Earth, he descends into a cave in Borneo, climbs a 90-foot mound of bat guano, only to find the top is covered with, as he calmly describes, a glistening carpet of cockroaches. Sir David Attenborough, he was knighted back in the 70s, has a new series and companion book called The Life of Birds. It includes footage from 42 countries and covers such topics as ancient bird evolution, flight, bird song, and mating habits. The series is airing now in England and coming to public televisions here in America this fall. I asked David Attenborough why it's taken him so long to get around to such an obvious and popular topic for a nature documentary.
Well, the real truth of the matter is that I'm not a kind of birdie man. That is to say, I have a lot of friends who are real birders, the sort of people who see a flash of a wing or hear about three notes of a whistle and can immediately say what bird that is. Now, I just can't do that. I wish I could. I admire those that do it, and I can't. But what interests me about birds is what birds do and why they do it. I've been expecting for the last 20 years that some of my birdie friends would do a series on birds, but they haven't, so I've taken the opportunity. And the great joy is that I've learned to actually, I can identify some birds now.
So you're birdier now?
I'm birdier than I was. But seriously, I think that identifying birds are one thing. And, of course, it's essential, really. I mean, being serious, you've got to know what it is you're looking at. But as far as I'm concerned, that's just the beginning. The exciting thing about studying birds, as indeed with any other animal, is looking at its behaviour, finding out why they do these extraordinary things, why they lay, one kind of bird will lay their eggs in another kind of bird's nest. That's what fascinates me.
Now, you tracked down some of some rather bizarre modern-day flightless birds who illustrate some of the characteristics of the ancient birds. You tracked them down in New Zealand, and one of them that was surprising to me was the kiwi. It's an odd-looking thing. It really doesn't look like a bird at all. It looks like it has fur. And it looks as if its wings had fallen off.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, of course, that one has to examine as to why it was that birds took to the air in the first place. And I personally think that there's no doubt at all that the reason they flew initially, as the reptiles became more and more powerful, was to escape. It was very important to get in the air. Now, if there are no ground predators, no ferocious animals that will eat a bird, birds give up flying, because flying, it demands a very great deal of energy. If you don't need to fly, you don't fly. And you can find lots of examples on islands around the world, in small islands where there have never been any ground predators, like, for example, the Galapagos. Cormorants stop flying. And there was one huge section of the Earth's crust that became separated from the rest of the continents just at that crucial time before the mammals developed, just at the end of the dinosaurian period. And that was New Zealand. And mammals never got there. Neither did the dinosaurs, in point of fact. Or if they did, they died out. And so suddenly the birds on that those two little fragments of land, which are New Zealand, had no need to fly. And so they, great numbers of them, I mean really dozens of different species, abandoned flight and took up all the roles within the landscape that a mammal would take elsewhere. That is to say, they became equivalent of squirrels or the equivalent of badgers. And the animal you mentioned, the kiwi, the bird you mentioned, is indeed the kind of avian equivalent of a badger. That is to say, its feathers have turned into a very good equivalent of fur. It's nocturnal. It lives in burrows. And it feeds on worms, which it gets by probing into the ground, very like a badger.
Now, many of the rare birds, at least on New Zealand, that you feature in the show don't seem to be afraid of you at all. Are they tame since they are so unused to people, to mammals?
That is the remarkable thing. It takes quite a long time for a species that has not an inbuilt fear of humanity to develop that. And you would think it would take longer, really. But in fact, it doesn't. I mean, even on the Galapagos and many of those places where there are animals that have evolved in isolation, they are almost suicidally tame. And the New Zealand native birds are touchingly tame. I mean, you can go into parts of the New Zealand forest and, well, do no more than bang on the surface of a tree. And within minutes, one or two particular species that are prone to this and are particularly interested in getting stuff out of bark will suddenly appear, and they'll sit down and come within a few feet of you. It's very touching and endearing.
Are there ethical considerations, then, in making the decision to invade these creatures' world? I mean, I imagine it's a physical stress for the birds, at the very least, to be near a human. Is that right?
I would be very sorry to think that we physically stressed any bird. I don't think we have. No, I really don't, because in point of fact, if a bird is stressed, it flies off, and that's the end of your sequence. It's the last thing you want, quite apart from any fellow feeling or humanitarian feeling you might have about a bird. It's bad broadcasting or it's bad filming if you stress the bird, because it will simply fly away. So, no, I mean, I think part of our craft as making natural history films is to make sure that the animals, whether they're birds or mammals or reptiles or whatever they are unstressed in your presence. If they're going to be stressed, then you shouldn't be there.
I'm talking with documentary maker David Attenborough. He is also a writer. He has a new book, The Life of Birds, and it's based on his new television series about birds, which is slated to air here in the States on PBS sometime in the fall. Let's talk, if we can, about bird songs. I think the first thing you learn about bird songs is that they're mating calls, but that's obviously not all they're doing when they chirp or they trill or whatever. What's going on when you walk through the woods and you hear the birds calling?
Well, there are a number of different kinds of calls, of course, that birds make. One of the kinds of calls that they make are communications among themselves, one of which is perfectly clearly, look out, there's danger. But there are two different kinds of danger, at least two different kinds of danger calls, because the trouble about making a danger call is that you call attention to yourself. And so there's a category of calls which are called seat calls, I mean, because it's a very, very high-pitched and unobtrusive call, but which is understood by different species, which thrushes and blackbirds, and I'm speaking now about European birds, but the same applies to American birds, they all understand a seat call as being watch out, don't fly out into the open, keep yourself hidden, there is danger around. There's another kind of alarm call, which is one when perhaps, a seat call is often a response to a hawk or something. If there is a cat, for example, or indeed a human being, The birds know that the cat, once they've spotted the cat is unlikely to be able to catch them. Its only chance is to catch a bird unawares. So they then make a very loud and continuous call, which, as it were, yells to the chorist and say there's danger, but also says to the cat, in effect, I can see you. There's no point in you wasting your time coming out. It's like, you're spotted, mate, you know. I can fly away, and you needn't bother waste your time stalking me. Then, of course, there is the call which you just described, which is not so much a call as, indeed, what birdwatchers will call not just a call but a song, which is rather more complicated. And the song carries not only the message, as you say, which is to say, why don't you come and join me and be my mate, but also says to other birds of the same species, look, don't pitch your tent here, mate, because this is my patch and this is my girl, so keep off.
You write about an interesting kind of communication between bird eggs, that bird eggs talk to each other.
Yes, indeed. You see, it is very important, if you nest on the ground, as some birds do, game birds, for example, or ducks, if you nest on the ground, predators can see after a bit, if you're not very careful, where your nest is, because you have to approach in certain ways, and that gets a track, and maybe there are droppings, and maybe there's a smell. The nest is being used, and the longer you use it, the more dangerous, the more chance there is that a predator will find it. So what you want to do, if you're a mother bird, is to lead your brood, your ducklings, your nestlings, lead them away from the nest to somewhere else which is safer and new and where they might find some food as soon as you can. Now, if you're going to do that, then it is very advantageous that all the eggs should hatch at the same time. But, of course, all the eggs aren't laid at the same time. A duck can't lay 12 eggs simultaneously, so they're laid at a day's distance or maybe even more. So, therefore, if they're all going to hatch at the same time, they have to develop at different rates. And eggs make little clicking noises as the birds develop and exercise their lungs. And these noises are heard, you can demonstrate by using recordings, are heard by other eggs, which will, according to the frequency of the clicks, will either speed up or slow down, so that eventually all the clutch hatch at the same time.
You have some amazing footage of birds' nests. I like the tailor bird of India. Mm. They sew their nests using their beak as a needle. How does that work?
Well, you just got to see it to believe it. Because if I describe it in words, you'd say, "Come on, do me a favor. That can't possibly work. How could a bird strip a fiber from a leaf?" Then fly across, bore a hole in the fringe of in the edge of a leaf, thread that piece of fibre through, then put it through another hole, tie a knot at the end of it, pull it tight, and then bring the fibre around and do that yet again until all the way down so that it ties the leaves together. You'd say, do me a favour. That is not possible. All I can say is that the tailor bird, does it. And it's breathtaking to watch.
My guest is a longtime BBC television producer and writer, David Attenborough. He's known for his documentaries on natural history, including Life on Earth, The Trials of Life, and The Private Life of Plants. His new series, The Life of Birds, is coming to PBS stations this fall. The companion book to The Life of Birds has just been published. We're going to take a break now, David, and then we'll talk some more. This is okay. Fresh Air. Back with broadcaster and writer David Attenborough. He has a new book, The Life of Birds. It's based on his new television series about birds, slated to air this fall on PBS. You go to some of the remotest places on Earth to film your documentaries. Have you run up against situations in which your kind of high-tech, bureaucratic BBC world clashed with the surroundings you found yourself in How, for instance, do people get in touch with you, you know, in the deepest, darkest jungle?
Well, it's a mixed blessing, of course, isn't it? I mean, I've been doing this kind of business for, well, for 40-odd years, and in the old days, one used to get a cameraman friend, and you and he would get in a canoe in Borneo, and you would wave to somebody or other, and then paddle off up the river, and you'd be gone for 4 months, and one would be living in longhouses with Dayak families, and you used to get up in the morning, and you'd think, well, there must be something that's going to happen. I mean, we'll just wander about and point our camera at whatever we happen to find. And you would live there for 3 months and come back with a certain quantity of film and hope to goodness that you were going to be able to construct something out of it. The world is not like that anymore. Now, thanks to American technology above any other, of course, you have a thing which is the size of a briefcase and you just open it and put it on your lap. And you open the lid and you take a compass bearing and you point it at the nearest, at where you know the nearest satellite is likely to be. And then you just dial your wife or your boss or the film editor to ask them how things were. And so you can be in daily contact if you want to be. The awful thing is that they can be in contact with you, which is not nearly so much fun.
Now, the early days of the BBC must have been quite a low-budget affair. Did you run into some seedy situations then in those weeks on the road? Bed bugs from Fleabag?
Oh, low-budget. You're dead right at low-budget. No, I said, you know, getting into a canoe and paddling off and just living in whatever happened, the tribal people you happened to meet. That's what it was. And that is between you and me. That, of course, is still about the nicest way you can do it. And you eat what they eat, and they are very hospitable and generous. And providing you sleep in the way that they sleep and eat in what they eat, and you go out with their hunters and you go out to look for those birds which they know where they are, you have just a great time. And there's no idea that you're living on caviar or down beds or fancy toiletries or these curious pressure baths or something. That doesn't happen.
Now, your programs don't get heavy-handed about environmental issues. I think, of course, you mention whenever it's relevant how humans have negatively affected the birds or whatever animals you're looking at. But you don't end each program with a true green message. What line do you try to walk in terms of affecting social change with these natural history shows?
Well, my job, I believe, is to tell people about the reality of animals. To tell people that we are blessed by living in an extraordinarily rich and fascinating world with a marvellous variety of extraordinary and beautiful things and fascinating things. Now, unless people are convinced that that is the case, unless they are convinced that the world is fascinating, rich and beautiful, and unless they understand that we are a part of it and dependent upon it, when someone comes along and says, don't fell that forest to make paper or whatever, because there's important things in it, unless they're convinced of that first thing I described, they will say, oh, well, why shouldn't we fell it? Why shouldn't we fell that forest? Conservation begins in understanding the value and importance and significance of the natural world. And that I regard as my primary job as a broadcaster. In private, I spend as much time working for conservation organisations as I do as in my professional life. And I don't think I've ever done a series in which I haven't at some stage ended the whole series, maybe, by talking about that particular issue. But the first job and the most important job, as far as I'm concerned, is convincing a population of the world which is becoming increasingly urbanised, increasingly town dwellers, increasingly cut off from the natural world, that the natural world is crucial to our survival.
I'm talking with David Attenborough. He's a longtime television producer and writer about the natural world. He's known for his documentaries, Life on Earth, The Trials of Life, The Private Life of Plants. His new series is The Life of Birds, and the companion book to The Life of Birds is out now. The series will air on PBS in the fall. Now, I'm curious if you have the experience of people in unlikely places or professions talking to you about scientific topics that they saw you exploring on TV? I mean, do bus drivers just recognize you and ask about Archaeopteryx?
Yeah, they say, what about altruism, Dave? They say, what do you mean? I mean, you know, what about these animals? Doesn't that destroy Darwinism, they say to me. They do.
I think I read somewhere that your local bobbies, your local police, would come to you and interrupt your dinner and drag you out somewhere to identify an adder.
Well, worse than adders, I have on occasion been summoned. I mean, I have been seen on television picking up a snake or something. So that, I mean, you get a call from the police saying, excuse me, sir, but we've got a bit of a problem. One of our public has noticed a snake sunning itself on the top of a wall. I wonder if you could give us an and. You see, so you go over. And the last time it happened, I found a snake, I think it was about 5 feet long, wonderful, handsome black, ebony black, but with golden rings around it. Now, there are two kinds of snakes like that. One is the banded krait, which is one bite, certain death job. and the other is a mangrove snake, which is back fang. That's to say, although it has got slightly poisonous fangs, they're not. It doesn't really bite, and it's perfectly all right. And it's a very common pet, you see. So I said, well, officer, I said, that's what we call a mangrove snake. So hang on, I'll get a small twig and I'll place it at the back of its neck and pick it up. And then if you've got a bag, I'll drop it in the bag, which is what duly happened. And then a fortnight later, I discovered, they rang me up again and said, we've discovered where your snake came from, sir. There's a man who is illegally importing banded krites, he said. So that was so much for my particular herpetological expertise. I nearly had heart failure.
Could have been the end.
Yes, it could.
Is there an animal that you just dream of encountering in the wild that you haven't yet?
Yes, I am besotted with birds of paradise. There are 42 different species of birds of paradise. They're all extraordinarily different from one another. They are mind-blowingly beautiful and interesting. And I think I've only seen 27.
So you have become a birder, after all.
Birds of paradise are different. You don't have to be a birder to be intoxicated with birds of paradise. I've been intoxicated with birds of paradise since I was 8.
Well, we'll let you off then.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, David Attenborough. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you.
David Attenborough's new TV series, The Life of Birds, is coming to public television stations around the country this fall. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, journalist Mark Hertzgaard discusses his travels around the world examining areas of environmental degradation. He has a new book. Maureen Corrigan tells us about the debut novel Amy and Isabel. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews 60 Minutes 2. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. First-time novelist Elizabeth Strout says she took up running in order to learn the pacing and endurance necessary to write a novel. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Strout's sweaty approach to writing paid off in her book, Amy and Isabel.
The temptation with a quietly lovely first novel like Elizabeth Strout's Amy and Isabel is to overpraise it, to slather on the exaggerated language and primary colored emotions that the novel itself steadfastly resists. But one of the best things about Amy and Isabel is its restraint, its precise wording, its circumscribed but deep story. So I want to be true to the tenor of Amy and Isabel in recommending it. This is a novel that beautifully captures vague feelings and disposable experiences. The discomfort of a poorly educated woman walking into a local bookstore. The excruciating embarrassment and fury of an adolescent girl when she hears her mother farting in the adjacent bedroom. I told you, these are disposable experiences. But the ordinary world that Amy and Isabel creates is as durable as kitchen linoleum. I'm sure scenes from this novel will linger in my mind long after episodes from flashier fiction wear out. The setting here is a Massachusetts mill town named Shirley Falls. The year is 1969. The novel opens on an oppressively hot summer's day in an unair-conditioned factory office room where a group of women are filing, typing, and chatting. The heat was relentless, Strout writes, and the fans rattling in the windows seemed to be doing nothing at all. And eventually the women ran out of steam, sitting at their big wooden desks with their legs slightly apart, lifting the hair from the back of their necks. Can you believe this? Was, after a while, about all that got said. One of the women, Isabel, holds herself a little bit apart from the rest. She's the boss's secretary, and her 16-year-old daughter, Amy, is also working in the office for the summer, languidly toting up invoices on an adding machine. At lunchtime, the women begin talking about a co-worker's hysterectomy and speculating on the impact it'll have on her sex life. At first, the reader assumes that the uneasy look that passes between Amy and Isabel is just one of those looks that gets exchanged between a shy teenager and her prissy mother when sex is mentioned. But through artfully scattered flashbacks, we learn that Amy has been caught making out in a car with her high school math teacher, Mr. Robertson. He's one of those hip, Room 222-type teachers who sprouted up in the late 1960s, and dreamy Amy, who lives in isolation with her widowed mother, was a natural for his predatory attentions. The summer's day the novel opens on turns out to be the very day Mr. Robertson has been run out of town by a horrified Isabel. Amy is devastated, but for the rest of that suffocating summer, she and her mother are stuck with each other, at home and at work. We're told that, when they spoke to one another, their words seemed pushed through the air like blocks of wood. In the small house, they moved past each other carefully, as though being near one another was a dangerous thing. But this only made them more aware of each other, joining them in a perverse intimacy of watchfulness. There are a lot of subplots in this novel. We watch as Isabel tries to ingratiate herself with her snooty neighbors and painfully learns her place. We hear about Amy's pregnant girlfriend and Fat Bev, a woman with bowels of iron and a heart of gold who works in the office. There's even a sketchy plot line about a UFO sighting and a child abduction. But Strout wisely knows where her true story lies. It's riveting to see how Amy and Isabel's relationship disintegrates and writes itself and changes day after stifling day during that long, hot summer. And when the weather breaks, it's not a doozy of a fictional storm, but a steady, intense, and delightfully plausible cooling rain.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Amy and Isabel by Elizabeth Strout. Thank you. Coming up, journalist Mark Hertzgard on environmental hotspots. This is Fresh Air. Nearly 10 years ago, journalist Mark Hertzgard started traveling the world to investigate an urgent story. As he writes in his new book, Earth Odyssey, the question driving him was whether the human species will survive the many environmental pressures crowding in on it at the end of the 20th century. Hertzgard has covered the environment and other topics for such publications as The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The Atlantic Monthly. He's also the author of three previous books, including On Bended Knee, About the Reagan Presidency, and Nuclear Inc., The Men and Money Behind Nuclear Energy. He says that often reporting on the environment is so abstract and scientific, it leaves him cold. In Earth Odyssey, he takes the issue down to a personal level by writing about the experiences he had traveling to many of the world's most polluted and environmentally devastated places, including China, the Sudan, the former Soviet Union, and Brazil. He says that seeing firsthand how severely people suffer in the developing world reminded him how we all were once at the mercy of the elements before technology. I asked him how this long view of environmental history changed his ideas about global environmental challenges facing us today.
Well, to me, it made me realize that the biggest environmental problem in the world today is not global warming, it's not ozone depletion, it's not species loss, as serious as all of those are. The biggest environmental problem today is poverty, because about 4 to 5 out of every 6 people on this planet live, by American standards, very impoverished lives. And when you travel in places like the Sudan, in places like China, where I also spent a lot of time, you realize that those people, quite understandably, are determined to improve their lot in life. And that is going to cause environmental consequences, even if you use green technology. So the big challenge, I think, facing humans in the next century is to find a way to accommodate that understandable desire for a better life that so many of us have with the carrying capacity of the planet.
You found that the Chinese have a saying that they say, is your stomach too full? Now, is that what they say when Americans talk about saving animals, saving birds, saving species?
Yeah, not just Americans. That is a very strong perception inside of China that hey, we have been poor for a very long time. You know, it's really only in the last 20 years that the majority of the Chinese people have been more or less warm in the wintertime. One of the great joys of this trip was to meet the individuals that I traveled with, and my interpreter in China was a great guy, very funny guy named Jen Bin, and he had grown up very, very poor in a village north of Beijing. And up until the age of about 12, and this is in a climate that's probably about as cold as Boston, the only thing his family had to stay warm with in the winter was to burn leaves and to burn corn stalks. As a result, the inside of their hut was often white with frost. Now, if you multiply that reality by about 1.2 billion people in China, you understand why today, when there's a little bit of money and the economy is beginning to grow, people are not only burning coal, but they will also tell you, in addition to, is your stomach too full, they'll say, look, I am used to it, and I will put up with this bad air pollution and this bad water pollution. Not that they like it, but it is a lot better than freezing through every winter.
Is there also the idea that you can, as you say, you can get used to anything, and you can also adapt to anything, that bad air that might harm you as a stranger, as a Westerner in China, that their bodies have adapted to that and they can live with it?
Yes, although, well, I'll tell you a funny story about Jen Bin. When we were in the southwestern Chinese city of Chongqing, which Americans who've been to China will know as the place where you take the boat rides to go down the Yangtze River, We were there, and we'd been traveling together for quite a while by then, and we uncovered this factory. In fact, it's the opening scene in the book, this factory that the local officials had said, oh, we closed this. This shows what good environmentalists we are. And we went there ourselves and sort of snuck our way in and saw that out the back of the factory was pouring literally a huge waterfall of chlorine into this river that was going to be people's drinking water. That night, Jianbin and I were out at a restaurant and having dinner, and he would, because I couldn't read Chinese, he would always suggest, okay, well, here's the menu, let's try this, this, and this. And he suggested fish. And I said, Jianbin, are you crazy? You know, that fish has to have come out of the Yangtze, and didn't you see what I saw today? And he said, well, if you don't want it, we don't have to have it, but I think it's pretty similar to what I eat in Beijing, and I'm used to it. And we went back and forth. I said, just because you think you're used to it doesn't mean it's good for you. And as we went back and forth, I finally realized that he was really still speaking as the peasant that he had been brought up with being, and did not understand the biology of cancer. He was thinking back to when you're a kid. He says, you know, I never take cold pills in the winter. I just build up my body's tolerance. Well, that works fine with influenza. It does not work with cancer. And, you know, what? Finally I was able to get the point across to him when I said, look, Jianbin, by that reckoning, smoking cigarettes would be fine as long as you started at the age of 8. And that finally broke through to him. Now, I hasten to add, he is an extremely well-educated person by Chinese standards. He went to graduate school in London, and yet he had never learned this very basic fact. And that's part of the real big problem in China. People think they can make themselves, as they say, used to it, and they just don't know better.
Let's talk about some of the other countries you visited with some bad air problems. Greece came up. I think somebody said, look, soon you won't be able to see the Acropolis till you stumble over it. It's so bad there. Did the people that you talked to in Greece have a different take on their air pollution problems than, say, the Chinese? Did you see real cultural divides or differences among people in how they justify or relate to the daily effects of pollution in their environment?
There were differences. The Greeks, of course, aren't as impoverished as the Chinese, and so their take on it is a little bit different. Everybody will complain about how dirty the air is in Athens, or in Paris, for that matter, or in London. I mean, air pollution of major cities is now an absolutely international phenomenon. What is interesting and what is common, in my experience throughout the world, is that it is always the other guy's fault. Nobody wants to stop driving their own car into Athens. And as illustrated by the fact that when it got to be really bad, and we're talking, you know, 800 people dying in one terrible two-week period in Athens because of this air inversion and the pollution, the government said, okay, we've got to do something. We're going to set up a system where the only people who can drive their cars into the city on Monday are people with odd-numbered license plates, and on Tuesday it'll be even numbers. So the idea was to cut the traffic down by 50%. Well, what did people do? They started stopping in. They're set up a ring all the way around the city. These mechanics would set up right outside the city limits, and for $20, you could come in. If you had the wrong numbered license plate, you could get them to put new plates on that you could drive into the city, and then they'd come out at night and they'd take them back off, and for $20, you were able to enter. That, I think, in a nutshell, shows you how difficult it is to change human behavior. Everybody always wants to say, it's the other guy's problem. I got to get downtown.
So what works? What have we found, just talking about the car, policies that work? You point out that technical fixes aren't keeping up with the sheer increase in numbers of automobiles, things like electric cars or fuel-efficient cars or catalytic converters.
Yeah, that is actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's a good example of the limits of technology. We've had actually some pretty impressive improvements on, if you will, the tailpipe technology, reducing the amount of pollution that comes out of the tailpipe, air pollution. So our skies here in the United States in particular are cleaner, but we are putting up still a lot of carbon dioxide to cause global warming. And even if you move to the fuel cell cars, which, you know, produce basically the only exhaust is water, you still are going to have the big problem of congestion. And to my mind, both in the United States and around the world, that is what is really going to be the problem of the car over the next 10 years. people getting more and more infuriated that this car, which is supposed to be a source of mobility, you know, is essentially a magic carpet in theory. Suddenly you're stuck in traffic and you can't get where you want to go. Now we've got to change policies at a very fundamental level to improve that. We've got to begin to really make public transport, mass transit, something that gets, instead of $1 out of every 7 federal dollars, it should be reversed. Right now we put 6 out of 7 dollars into highways, and we've got to make a much more equal distribution, and we've got to change our land use policies. But these are very long-term kinds of social changes, so I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
I'm talking with journalist Mark Hertzgard. He writes for many national publications, including the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic Monthly. He's written a new book about environmental change, our attitudes towards the environment and environmental degradation. It's called Earth Odyssey. Let's talk a little bit about population growth. You went to Brazil, and one of the, of course, the big environmental challenges in that country is deforestation. And population growth is often blamed for that. But there's a lot of complex political factors at work, too. How did you go about unraveling how much population matters?
In Brazil, I was there to cover the Earth Summit, and then after that I went up to the Amazon. And I was lucky enough to be running around with some priests who worked up in the Amazon, and I got to know their parishes and the people with them. And I remember one day we were, in fact, I tell this story in the book about traveling downriver with them, and the family who ran their boat had nine kids. And you look at that, and in fact, I got a call from a magazine editor that day saying, hey, why don't you do a story on population? And I said, well, I just got off a boat with a family with nine people. And it seems easy from that point to say, ah, well, that's why all that rainforest is being cut down in Brazil. And I think many Americans take this sort of knee-jerk assumption that it's their problem down there. If they'd just stop having so many kids, we wouldn't have an environmental crisis. Well, when you look a little more carefully, what you realize in the case of Brazil is that, you know, Brazil actually does not have a terribly dense population out in its rural areas. There's density in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. But in fact, outside of that, it's a very sparsely populated country. And the reason that the rainforest is being cut down is not that there's too many people, but that there's too little social equality. There's not enough land in Brazil open to peasants. About 50% of the land is owned by 1% of the population. And I met a lot of land squatters who would say, look, we got kicked off of the farm where we were working for the rancher, and what could we do? The only option we had was to go into the rainforest and to cut down some rainforest to create cropland for ourselves. Unfortunately, the soil is so weak there in the tropical areas that after about 2 or 3 years, it doesn't produce anymore. They have to go further into the rainforest, cut down more trees, and it becomes a vicious circle. And the solution to this is, again, quite straightforward: land reform. You've got to more equally distribute the land. There's plenty of land there. It's just being used improperly now.
Now, what do you think the consequences are for that kind of attitude among people? You went back to the United States and you had someone say exactly that to you. Hey, look, it's not our fault. You know, these people are so badly off in Brazil. Why don't they stop having so many kids? What do you say back to people like that?
That was a friend of mine who said that. I was passing through San Francisco on the way to Brazil. And when he said that, I had to bite my tongue, because it's part of the reason that people outside of America sometimes get infuriated with Americans, because the Americans tend to not know very much about the rest of the world and to be especially blind to our own environmental burdens. The fact is that the average American baby, because we live such a much more material, excessive life, the average American baby, over the course of his or her lifetime, will produce 13 times as much pollution, will use 13 times as many natural resources as a Brazilian baby. So my friend who said that, who had two kids, if you multiply 2 by 13, he essentially had 26 kids. Compared to João and Margarita, who had the 9 children, you know, he had 3 times as much environmental burden as they did. So population is important. but it is by no means the most important aspect of the environmental crisis. And I would just say that Americans have to be careful about throwing stones when you live in a glass house.
Mark Hertzgard, thanks very much for talking with me on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Hertzgard's new book is Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. And that's the Jessica Williams Trio. Coming up, a review of the new 60 Minutes. This is Fresh Air. Last night, the longest-running TV series in prime time, 60 Minutes, finally gave birth to a spin-off, 60 Minutes 2, with different correspondents but the same overall look. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Loyal fans of the original 60 Minutes, which has been around and thriving since 1968, can relax. The new 60 Minutes 2, based on last night's premiere, is indeed a spin-off, not a rip-off.
I'm Dan Rather.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Vicki Mabry.
I'm Mike Wallace. Those stories tonight on the very first broadcast of 60 Minutes 2.
Except for the red letter numeral 2 in the top right corner, this was our father's 60 Minutes. Same stopwatch, same graphic look, same no-frills presentation, same long and unusual stories. Last night's 60 Minutes 2 contained three stories, with political commentator Jimmy Tingle joking at the end. The first story, about a secret city in Siberia that has been producing nuclear materials since the 50s, clocked in at just over 14 minutes. The second story, on behind-the-scenes political player David Shippers and his role in the presidential impeachment effort, was longer than 11 minutes. The third story, an update on a classic 60 Minutes piece, was nearly 13 minutes. The length was impressive. So was the depth. The best of the three was the opening piece, presented by Dan Rather and produced by Tom Anderson. Thanks to great footage and interviews from reporter George Kreil, we were taken inside the secret Russian city, which really did look like some lavish secret headquarters out of a James Bond movie. Though it would have been a strong story just by showing us that city, 60 Minutes 2 upped the ante by explaining that the real story is that the place continues to generate plutonium, and that the real fear is that some of that nuclear material will find its way into the hands of international terrorists. Other stories in the inaugural broadcast were provided by Carol Marin and veteran 60 Minutes host Mike Wallace, who handled opening night hosting chores on this show as well. As for the regular 60 Minutes 2 contributors, Bob Simon merely introduced Marin's piece, while all we heard from Charlie Rose and Vicky Mabry was them introducing themselves in the show's opening credits. But that will change in coming weeks, and each contributor to 60 Minutes 2 will get a chance to shine. The ratings, compared to the original, won't come close. 60 Minutes owns Sundays, but CBS doesn't even have a lease on Wednesdays. The content, however, is no watered-down version. Even Jimmy Tingle and his hard Boston accent made a good first impression. And first impressions in the competitive world of network television count for a lot.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Al Banks and Bob Purdick. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, and Little Brown & Company, publisher of Peter Goronek's follow-up to Last Train to Memphis, Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Fosse, the new show celebrating the work of Bob Fosse, opens this week. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Gwen Verdon and Bebe Neuwirth tell us about bringing his unique choreography style to the stage. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.